from her modest beginnings to becoming the 10th woman and 3rd American woman to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, Jody Williams is here to describe the ups and downs of her tumultuous and remarkable life. Williams describes her Catholic roots, her first step on a long road to standing up to bullies with the defense of her deaf brother Stephen, her transformation from good girl to college hippie at the University of Vermont, and her protest of the war in Vietnam. She relates how in 1981 she began her lifelong dedication to global activism as she battled to stop the U.S.-backed war in El Salvador. Throughout the memoir, My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize, Williams underlines her belief that an average woman, through perseverance, courage, and imagination, can make something extraordinary happen. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jody Williams to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for asking me. I'm excited to talk to you.
Well, an absolute delight. At what point did you know, did you start to realize that you could make a difference, that you had a power?
Oh, goodness. I was old, to be honest. I was a scaredy-cat kid. I was afraid of authority. It really wasn't probably until I protested Vietnam in 1970, but still was not clear about my future like most college kids. It wasn't until 1981, and I started volunteering to try to stop U.S. intervention in El Salvador, that I recognized I wanted to try to help make a difference in the world. But I didn't think of it as power per se. It was just I knew I needed to do something, not just complain.
It could be said, and not to get overly psychological on you, but it could be said that you have to be that scaredy cat initially to be as effective as you became.
I don't know. I'd never thought about it that way. I actually thought once a scaredy cat, always a scaredy cat.
But it's almost like you are unleashing this again, go to that word power, but you're unleashing this sense of yourself to say, okay, I want to change this, mm-hmm. and if no one else is going to do it, well, here I am to lock arms with my brothers and sisters and make something happen.
Yes, I think that's the case. I mean, I think about when we started the landmine campaign, it was the fact that nobody was looking at the long-term impact of landmines. You know, militaries were happy to lay them, but there was no discussion about what happened when the militaries went home and the landmines stayed there for, you know, generations, to be literal about it. And we started talking and thinking, well, nobody else is doing anything. We don't need permission. Let's see what we can do to at least make people's lives on the ground better.
You touch on this, you talk about this in the book, and I find it fascinating because we use the term a lot, and I think its meaning ultimately gets lost, which is a grassroots activist.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you're the poster child for this, in the sense...
Well, that's a nice thing to say. That's actually how I'd like to be remembered, as one hell of a grassroots activist.
But for you, what does that mean? In the sense of that you can go from the lowest levels, and, mm-hmm. and not to put down the state of Vermont in any way, shape, or form, but here in the state of Vermont, you can start there and make a difference.
I really think it's kind of like what you were saying. It's discovering not just your power, but you have rights that we're all willing to defend, correct? Our human rights.
Right.
But we're too often willing to overlook our responsibilities as citizens and as people in the world. And, you know, somehow I recognized that I had a responsibility to try to do something to make the world a better place. And you can do it if you work with other people who share your same goals. It's not magic. It's just hard work every day.
Do you know what it was about the issue of landmines? Do you know what it was about that particular troublesome mm-hmm. policy that struck you?
I wish that I could say it was my brilliance and insight, but it wasn't. At that point, I was still working to stop U.S. military intervention in El Salvador, and I was kind of tricked into coming to a meeting in Washington between a German fellow, Tomas Gebauer, who was supporting some of the work we were doing in Salvador, and Bobby Muller, the president of Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. And they started talking about this new clinic that they were founding in Cambodia, training amputees to build prosthetic limbs for the, you know, thousands and thousands of amputees there. And all of a sudden, they turn and look at me and say, you know, we think that we need to ban landmines, and we think you'd be great at trying to bring non-governmental organizations together to do it. And I was flabbergasted. You know, I was just sitting there because I'd been Tomas's ride, and I was going to take him to the airport after the meeting. I didn't know they'd been conspiring, you know, to try to get me to consider doing this campaign. And it was actually when Bobby, who was a Vietnam vet and wounded from the spine down and is taking the last hill while in Vietnam, of course, explained to me the difference between other conventional weapons that go home with the soldiers and landmines that stay, that it suddenly became an exciting proposition to think about trying to get rid of these weapons, and also maybe through the prism of the impact of landmines, you could get people to understand other long-term impacts of war and why we really need to learn conflict resolution instead of always, you know, picking up the gun and going after the so-called enemy.
Why is that such a hard sell? Why do we repeat this again and again and again?
Well, I remember George W. saying that, you know, if you want peace, you have to prepare for war. And I think that's bull. I think you get what you prepare for. And we do not value conflict resolution in this country. We glorify violence, as we all know. You know, the video games and the movies, and we teach our history through the glories of, you know, overcoming the wilderness of America and World War II, et cetera, instead of teaching kids from kindergarten how to learn to make compromise, how to, you know, think about what's good for everybody instead of just me, me, me. And we get what we prepare for. We don't prepare human beings in this country, or pretty much anywhere, to think about compromise, resolution, and moving forward together. We think about conquering the enemy.
And you wonder, after just our, you know, our 200 plus years as a nation dealing with these issues, and having that be the MO through over, you know, almost three centuries. So, you know, at what point do we, if not now, when do we turn around and say, well, maybe that's not a great idea?
I think that there is a growing sense that we have to do things differently. And obviously, you know, confronting what, you know, President Eisenhower himself called then the emerging military-industrial complex, you know, confronting that now is even more difficult because it's huge, the billions and billions of dollars that go to the what we call here around D.C., the Beltway Bandits, who are the defense industry who gets lots of money for developing new weapons. Confronting that and beginning to get people to look at other options than war is going to take a long time. But that doesn't mean you should just say it's impossible and we don't start. There are many programs these days that are trying to teach kids about peace and that it's not kumbaya, my lord, it's not a dove, it's not a rainbow, it's work. But that there are many ways to contribute to sustainable peace, and each and every one of us can be part of it.
When you find out that you'd won the Nobel Peace Prize, and you see that, I mean, and you get the call in the middle of the night, and there's already people camped out on your front lawn waiting to talk to you when this happens. So,
go ahead. No, I'm sorry. I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
No. So this happens, and you. It has to be something that blindsides you, that you don't expect it.
Uh-huh. We knew that we'd been nominated, okay? We knew that there had been various configurations, if you will. The International Committee of the Red Cross, for example, had been nominated. Senator Leahy had been nominated. The Foreign Minister of Canada, who actually challenged the world to negotiate the treaty in 1 year, had been nominated. And we recognized that something amazing had happened with civil society, the campaign, with the Red Cross, with governments coming together to make this happen. And it wouldn't be far-fetched if it was recognized by the Nobel Committee. Certainly, we did not think it would be me in the campaign. And that was rather shocking. I was thrilled for the campaign. I was astounded about myself, and it took me actually many years to adjust to what that meant.
So when you put it into perspective and realizing that happened in 97,
mm-hmm.
that you look at where we are now and the great work that you had as an organization and a group and personally, the great work that you accomplished, where are we now? Are we, because it would be wonderful to say, okay, yes, we did this, we accomplished this, we won the prize, and the problem is solved.
No. The thing, I think the marvel of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines is that we recognize that the treaty was the beginning. It wasn't the end result, it wasn't the victory. With the treaty, we had, you know, the groundwork upon which we could actually get countries to obey, give up the landmines, destroy the stockpiles, get the mines out of the ground. We committed to the long term to make sure that governments obeyed the treaty and that, you know, things really changed on the ground. And I think that's another thing that activists really have to understand. It's not, you know, a one-off, whoopee, let's do a campaign to end hunger for 6 months, you know, and then move on to the next hot topic. If you want to bring about sustainable change, you really have to be committed to moving the issue along in such a way that it becomes, you know, part of the political process and continues, if I'm making any sense in saying that.
No, you are, very much so. So where do you feel that we are now? Where does your optimism lie?
Well, you know, it wasn't just the landmine campaign that was successful. In 2008, other NGOs that had been part of our campaign were successful in banning cluster munitions. The treaty was signed in Oslo, Norway, at the end of 2008. In April of this year, my organization, Nobel Women's Initiative, Human Rights Watch, Pugwash conferences, which deal with nuclear weapons, and several others, are going to be launching a new campaign in London on April 23rd to stop killer robots. And I know that that sounds a bit inflammatory, but it's purposeful. A killer robot is a fully autonomous weapon, not a drone. It's weapons where there's no human being involved in the lethal attack and kill, which I find just horrifying. It terrified me when I learned about it when I was doing an article about the illegality of the use of drones. So we're forging ahead with that new campaign. The Nobel Women's Initiative is spearheading the international campaign to stop rape and gender violence in conflict. I think that people really have come to understand that while individual organizations can be doing fantastic work, when you come together and continue your individual fantastic work, but you come together in a coordinated, communicating campaign, you can accomplish a lot more. And that's one of the things I think I'm most proud of coming from the Landmine campaign. We were able to help, you know, grassroots activists understand that if you work together, you can do extraordinary things in the world.
Well, the name of the book is My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. It is an incredible look about your life as an activist, and it is obviously about an incredible woman. Jody, I thank you very much for being with us. I thank you for all the wonderful work you have done with your colleagues to make the world a better place, and I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks for inviting me. It was fun.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Coming up next, we will have an update from the Linda as well as Sean Stone from Metroland. First, the news from NPR and Writer's Almanac. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.